This is Kelly Blewett. I'm joined tonight by Amy Gary, who has just published a new biography about children's book legend Margaret Wise Brown. Brown is the author of such classics as Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny, as well as dozens of other titles published between 1940 and 1960. When researching Brown, Amy Gary had the unbelievable good luck to be given a trunk of unpublished manuscripts by Brown. Amy's new book, In the Great Green Room, offers a look at this children's literature icon in light of these materials. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
So tell us about the trunk. How big was it? What did it look like?
I guess we used to call them hope chests long ago, I guess is the size. So it was you know, something like 3 feet long and 2 feet high. And when she told me that she had this trunk of manuscripts, or actually she first said, I have a manuscript. It's stored in the trunk in my barn. I thought, she lives in Vermont. So I thought, there's no way anything could survive those winters. The papers could, but I guess it's the cold winters actually preserve them, because when she actually opened the trunk and said, here's the manuscript I told you about, which was called The Green Wind, the big manuscript of like 200 poems. And she said, and then here's all the others. And it was literally end to end within that trunk, filled with onion skin papers just stacked on their sides with rusty paper clips.
Onion skin paper is so thin, too.
It is. And there were some other ones thrown in. Like, she had some music scores that were a little thicker. But really, it was, for the most part, it was that very delicate onion skin paper.
And we should say that the she to whom you're referring is Margaret's sister, Roberta?
Yes, it was. I had been working with Roberta to bring back some of Margaret's old books that had fallen out of print. And we developed a friendship over the time, because she had a farm with horses. I had horses. We both had collies. And so we really had a lot to talk about. It was so interesting to listen to her, because she didn't see Margaret as anything really all that special. I mean, these were stories that Margaret was writing that had been part of their childhood. Goodnight Moon was a ritual Margaret and Roberta shared through childhood. At night, they would go to bed and they would say goodnight to the things in their room.
Yes, and also the two sisters were very different in terms of personality, as you sort of bring out in the book.
Yes, they were. Roberta was a college professor of physics at Vassar. And then you had Margaret, who always had the boys buzzing around her because she was absolutely beautiful. So I think the contrasts were very much part of their sibling rivalry, I guess I should say.
Now, you had all of these papers, and I'm just imagining all these onion skin papers. Where did you put them? How did you organize them? Where are they now?
I brought in the staff of people to come and type up everything that we had, because they were so delicate, even copying them at times. I actually copied them while I was at Roberta's first. I didn't want them to disappear. So when I first saw them, I literally would go to the bank, get a roll of quarters, take a handful of the manuscripts, go to the library and copy the manuscripts, and then return those to Roberta and start again until I had the whole trunk copied, because I was so afraid that something might happen to them. But I knew that this was a treasure, and I didn't want them to disappear. So eventually, Roberta donated those to Hollins University, and they are there at Hollins now. There's another library that has some of her other papers. Westerly, Rhode Island, the public library there has a lot of her written manuscripts. Most of what I had there in that trunk were typed manuscripts, but a lot of her handwritten ones were there. Her book dummies are at Westerly. And a book dummy, just to explain, is something you make up and show to a publisher, a pretend book. And Margaret's ideas were so far ahead of anything else that was being published that when she went to sell one of her manuscripts that were unusual, sort of a novelty type of manuscript, she would create a dummy book and take it in so she could show the publisher how, like, for example, a mouse was supposed to be attached to a ribbon on the book and then wind its way through an open hole within the book. Or recently, we just had this beautiful manuscript, North, South, East, West, published, and that was published with HarperCollins. Her original design was to have that bound on four sides and cross-cut so that you actually read the story in the round. That even today is something financially that would not be something we could really do. It just, the expense would be enormous. So even today, her ideas are not necessarily something that can actually be mass produced.
When you were initially going through the materials, did you have a sense of how they would change or enhance Margaret Wise Brown's legacy? And did that bear out as you did the research and wrote this book?
It certainly did. At first, when I looked at those, I thought, okay, surely Roberta was wrong. Most of these must be published. So it took me a long time to research them all to make sure that, indeed, these were unpublished. And bit by bit, I confirmed that over time. But I think that what really stuck out in my mind was how everything cut off at Margaret's death. She died suddenly at the age of 42 after an appendectomy. She had an embolism and died suddenly. So all of her publishers stopped publishing her works at that moment. And normally you have like about 5 years worth of works in the pipeline, as we say, in a publishing house. But everything stopped. And I didn't know exactly why when that first happened, because there was so much material in there. And in fact, there were contracts, canceled contracts for books that I also found eventually through Roberta's papers. So why did it all come to a screeching halt was because, number one, I think that it took many years for them to settle the estate. Mm-hmm. But a lot of her publishers or friends or editors didn't want to change any of Margaret's words or put things, you know, if something wasn't exactly, they wanted her help to get these to press. And so eventually those editors left and new publishers were willing to take a look at all of these wonderful manuscripts.
I want to talk a little bit about Goodnight Moon, because I think most of our listeners will know the book, and maybe, like me, they will have spent hours reading it to their children. But I learned quite a bit in this book that I didn't know about Goodnight Moon. So could you tell us a little bit about where the idea for Goodnight Moon came from?
Well, the very first idea came to her through the childhood ritual she had where she would say goodnight to things in her room. But Margaret's first job was to write for a textbook for a school. It was called the Progressive Movement, and they could teach math and science to girls and boys equally. But when you began to look at literature and teach girls and boys the same sort of literature, you realize that you're depending on fairy tales that demeaned girls in some ways, were violent, and might have subjugated girls or told them that marriage was the ultimate goal. So Margaret and her mentor, Lucy Mitchell, were writing a textbook that would let children live in what they called the here and now, the stories of their own lives. A story would meet them where they are here and now in their growth and development. So Margaret had written a poem to go into one of those textbooks that she drew on from her own teen years. She'd spent many years away at a boarding school, and she came home one day to a house that was full of furniture, and it was all of her childhood furniture that she treasured. And so that night, she said goodnight again to all the things in her room. Even though she was a teen, she was still using that ritual. And even as an adult, I found in her diaries where she would go through and say goodnight to the things in her room as well, and loving her little things on the shelf, as she said. And it was something she did over and over again throughout her life.
She also had a dream, didn't she?
She did. She visited a neighbor's apartment, and she was commenting about his incredible, vivid colors within this apartment. She said it felt like walking into a Spanish painting. It was green walls, red furniture with bright yellow trim.
Yes.
And that night, she dreamed Goodnight Moon, but instead of it being her childhood toys, it was her own bedroom. It was her black telephone by the bed. It was her brush, and it was in this great green room. And so she almost, not immediately, but within a couple of months, painted her own bedroom that bright green and bought, as she said, a Christmas bed, big red bedspread. And she was terrified that the room would look a little too Christmassy, so she painted one wall yellow.
Isn't it right that the fireplace that's in the illustrations by, is it Clement Hurd?
Yes.
Is, in fact, the same fireplace that was in one of her homes in New York?
Yes, and it was in her writing studio that she called Cobble Court. And in fact, in the book, we have a photograph of her actually lighting a fire at that fireplace. And that house still stands today in New York. It is in Greenwich Village, but it was a tiny little single home, which is fairly unusual in New York. And the fireplace is still there. People walk by and see that little quirky house with the cobblestone courtyard that still exists.
You know, as a biographer, it seems like you had this opportunity to really engage with a Margaret that so many of us don't know, and then you shared that with us in the Great Green Room. I wondered if you could characterize the Margaret that you met in a few short words.
Vivacious certainly comes to mind, doesn't it? She grabbed life and she lived it, and she lived it in her own way. She had relationships with men and women and made no apologies for it, and really lived a life of getting out into nature and exploring. She had one of the most curious minds I think, around. I could tell that just from her reading her diary. She was always wondering what was next, how she could turn another story over and make it something new, how she could create another way for children to engage in story and song and music. She was endlessly fascinating, and she wrote endlessly fascinating books. And what people don't understand about children's books is how difficult it is to write for a child. I mean, everybody thinks it's going to be easy because it's so few words, but you don't understand that you have to carry the same emotional impact that you would in an adult story, but you have to use fewer words, number one, and they have to be written at a specific age level. And so one of her tricks was to study a subject and then take children to explore that same subject, like going to the docks to see boats, going out and picking flowers, and she would listen to how the children described their time and write down the words as fast as she could, the words that they used to describe things, because then you could give them back their own vocabulary at the age level they were at.
Yeah, and I actually, that leads so beautifully into a short quote that I wanted to read from the book that is the way that you characterize Margaret's early days at Bank Street, taking her stories into the classroom, reading them to children, and this is what you write. It was soon clear to Margaret that her own stories lacked a certain spark. Her writing was stilted, not at all as effortless as a child's own language. It took a while for Margaret to understand what felt false in her simple lines, but one day she realized she was talking down to children in her writing. Somewhere along the way, she, like many adults, had forgotten how it felt to be a child. And that's the end of the quote. It's so interesting that she turned to children to kind of access that language and then repackage it.
She respected children's minds and their thoughts and really did see them as full human beings. She did not look down on them. She thought that they were really adventurers like she was, but their adventure was going through childhood. And she wanted to give them books that would help them see their own world and understand their own world in new ways. I think she said at some point that you had to learn to love what they loved. That was, she said, was the secret to writing good children's books, is to really love what they love.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I've been talking to Amy Gary, the author of In the Great Green Room, a terrific new biography of children's book legend Margaret Wise Brown. For more information on this title, visit our website at wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. This is Kelly Blewett.